Okay, that's quite enough of that. Welcome, everyone, to In the Cage with Bards, Vancouver's only dedicated show about mixed martial arts. One another beautiful day out. We've got a great summer in the city of Vancouver. Hope everyone enjoyed their long weekend. But no rest for the wicked. The dust has settled on UFC's Live on Versus 2 card, and John Bones Jones continues his march up the light heavyweight ladder. Jones wasted no time in taking out veteran Vladimir the Janitor Matyushenko, getting the veteran in a crucifix position and finishing him off with elbows from the top, just 152 into round one. Jones showed some of his trademark flash, nailing Matyushenko with a spinning back kick before securing the takedown and moving into the mounted crucifix. After dismantling Matyushenko, the time may have come for Jones to fight the bigger names in the division. Rumor has it that a fight with ultra-popular Forrest Griffin could be in the cards. And Jones may be as popular as Griffin if he keeps on putting in performances like that. My personal highlight of the fight was during his victory speech when he told San Diego, "You stay classy." In the semi-main event, Yushin Thunder Okami was able to grind out a decision victory over NCAA wrestling champ Mark Munoz. Okami was able to stuff Munoz's takedowns and sap his energy to set up a dominant third round. Even though the scoring of the fight seemed elementary, one judge somehow scored it for Munoz, making Okami's win a split decision. That judge? That's right, people. None other than Cecil Peoples. Yes. Again. I don't know what it's going to take for the state of Nevada, the state of California. I'm just in a state of denial about how bad this guy is and what it's going to take to get his license revoked. Now, the win puts Okami back in the middleweight title hunt. Considering Okami's plodding and somewhat boring style, that's good news for almost no one outside of Yushin Okami's immediate family. Also on the card, the welterweight showdown between Jake Ellenberger and John Howard ended early when doctors ruled Howard's eye was too swollen to continue at 221 into the third round. Ellenberger used his wrestling ability to control Howard on his back and hit a series of elbows in the second to cause Howard's eye to eventually swell shut. My personal favorite, again, I hate to keep going back to the announcing, but sometimes, you know, as a radio person, you get a kick out of this kind of things. During the announcement, Bruce Buffer announced Ellenberger's name like it was two separate names, like Ellen was his middle name or something. It always came out, Jake Ellenberger! I don't know, maybe it's a new nickname for him, Ellen. I like it. It could work for him. The evening opened with the bang as the Fireball Kid, Takanori Gomi, came out swinging and crushed Tyson Griffin with a right hook just 64 seconds into the fight. Gomi has put the rest of the lightweight division on notice with his performance, coming off a disappointing loss to Kenny Florian. The KO win looked like vintage Gomi, who came into the UFC from Japan with a lot of hype. Gomi seemed pleased enough with his performance. He scaled the cage and frantically was trying to get UFC President Dana White's attention, waving his arms and yelling, "Dana! Dana!" It was almost like a kid that just jumped off the high dive and wanted to make sure his dad saw him. It was cute. All right, there's a lot to do today. We have got the voice of MMA, Mauro Ranallo, joining us. And we've also got to talk about Anderson Silva taking on Chael Sonnen this weekend. A lot's happening. I'm going to take a quick break, and then we're going to go back and get right back to it.
The UBC Ski and Snowboard Club is a nonprofit, democratic, student-run organization dedicated to promoting the sports of skiing and snowboarding and the associated lifestyle.
We endeavor to make skiing and snowboarding accessible and fun by actively seeking out the best deals and discounts for our members, as well as organizing trips to local ski areas and setting up numerous social events.
Come on one of our legendary trips and explore the glory of riding in British Columbia. Or join us at the bar to discover the true meaning of debauchery. Ask your roommate, ask your parents, ask the RCMP. Who has the most fun at UBC? You'll get the same answer. The Ski and Snowboard Club.
Duh. Joining the Ski and Board Club is easy. Come by our office, sub 115, anytime with some money to become a member. Your membership gives you access to all the deals offered by our sponsors, cheap beverages at our parties, an invitation to all club events, and of course, only members can come on the trips. Yeah!
I'm gonna chow down my vegetables. I love you most of all, my favorite vegetable.
Sprouts. It's your 75-cent coffee fix in the sub.
It's your source for reasonably priced, creatively named stew and vegan brownies.
It's your purveyor of bicycle-delivered local produce.
It's also a place where volunteers can realize their vision of responsible business and where like-minded students can explore UBC's food systems.
Hark! Sprouts is currently accepting applications for next year's executive board and is encouraging ambitious, creative, and disciplined students from all faculties and year levels to apply.
Come by Sprouts in the sub-basement to learn more about our projects and how to get involved.
I tried to kick the ball, but my tinny flew right off. I'm red as a beet, 'cause I'm so embarrassed.
UBC Rec is everything that is recreation on campus. No matter how you play, UBC Rec is your resource for fun activities. This student program is operated by over 140 volunteers, and it is the largest intramural recreation organization in Canada. Programs cover fitness, instructional classes, outdoor recreation, drop-in sports, special events, small tournaments, and intramural leagues. All the registration information is available in the Student Recreation Center or online at rec.ubc.ca. UBC Rec, how do you play?
And we're back here on In the Cage with Bards, and we are now joined by the voice of MMA himself, the one, the only, Mauro Ranallo. How are you, Mauro?
I'm doing very well. Nice to be on with you in my old stomping grounds of beautiful British Columbia. My brother, who's now a Vancouver police officer, actually graduated from UBC, so a pleasure to be with you.
Great, thanks. I was glad to hear that. You said your brother's a cop. Can you get any ticket fixed for me or anything?
Yeah, exactly. I'm still trying to get a few of my transgressions fixed. He's one of those militant cops. You know how they are.
Yeah, one step at a time, I guess.
Yeah.
Before we get too far into this, I got to ask you this. Can I get a yo-yo-yo and away we go?
Oh, my. Starting back when I was 16. Yo-yo-yo and away we go!
Thank you very much. Sorry, had to be done.
I still don't even know what the genesis of that was. Many people have asked me. I was an old-time fan of, a promotion that I actually worked for at the beginning of the decade in pro wrestling, Stampede Wrestling. And I remember back in the day that the avuncular host, Ed Whalen, always started the program with an Away We Go, which, of course, was a ripoff of the old comic legend, Jackie Gleason. So for some reason, doing PA announcements back in the day for W.J. Mowat Sr. out in Abbotsford, British Columbia, I was like the voice of every sport imaginable for them. And for some reason, it became Yo-Yo-Yo and Away We Go, and I've stuck with it for 24 years, not really knowing why. I guess it's just knowing that once those words come out of my mouth, I know it's showtime for me.
It's showtime. As we said, you got into broadcasting as a very young age, 16, you said. So
yes.
I guess it was always your dream to be behind the microphone?
Well, I am one of those individuals, and I thought there was many more of us out there, but I keep running into people who keep calling me the luckiest bastard alive, that I knew at a very young age what I wanted to do. And really, truthfully, I can remember being 4, 5, 6 years old and just very enamored with all of the broadcast mediums, whether it's television or radio. And I actually visualized at a very young age, not knowing what visualization was at the time, what I wanted to do, what I knew I was probably best at. And it was communicating. And whether it was in grade one, narrating school plays, to being the PA announcer throughout high school, being a disc jockey and a radio DJ, a club DJ, working for Community Access TV, I knew at a very, very young age what I wanted to be, and I've been very, immensely blessed to be able to do what I do at the level that I do it at, because, I look around me, and not everyone is happy with their lives, and you look at the economy and everything else. I've been very blessed, and that's the best way to describe it. So, yeah, from very young, I knew what I wanted to do in life.
So when you're watching Hockey Night Canada like the rest of us, instead of wanting to grow up and be Wayne Gretzky, you wanted to grow up and be Bob Cole?
That was it. Or for me, it was really Jim Robson. And believe it or not, as a the radio voice of the Langley Hornets of the BCHL a few years ago, I actually, I'm almost the Forrest Gump of broadcasting. Everything I want to accomplish or people I want to meet or interview, I have had the pleasure of doing so. And then again, one of my career highlights was interviewing the legendary former voice of the Vancouver Canucks, Jim Robson. So for me, it was more, the Jim Robsons of the world and the Howard Cassells and whatnot, but I always knew at a very young age too that, you know, in order to really stand out, you've got to be yourself. And whether you like me or hate my style, I've always tried to be true to who I am and not be anything I'm not. And then that's the one thing that still kind of perplexes me a bit is everyone thinks my voice is some kind of a put on or some kind of a performance.
It's engineered by science, I believe.
Yeah, blessing or not, man, this is what God gave me. And over the years, obviously, it's changed. But, people have to realize I've been practicing for, I'm in my 40th year on Earth now. And it's been almost that long since I've been talking and doing what I do. So, it's just, like I say, I'm just very happy to be able to say that I get up in the morning and smile on my way to work and love every single second of it.
How does one get an amazing voice like that? Are you on a steady regimen of Jack Daniels and cigarettes, or what should I be trying here?
Yeah, the diet of razor blades, right? No, I, being a full-blown Italian, come from a family with people with booming voices. My dad has a pretty big voice, and just, the Italian's very loud and boisterous and whatnot, and really, I just think it's they say it's a gift and some will say it's a curse, but this is just what I was given. And I remember even being very young though, with reading and doing stuff in school, and everyone always just say there's something different about you. You read it with a certain flair and a certain drama. So like I say, I've been rehearsing and performing all my life. So I mean, my voice has been used a lot. Some ex-girlfriends would say way too much, but it's what it is. Leave it or take it or leave it. I see Seth MacFarlane has done very well with his set of pipes, so I'm aspiring to reach that tax bracket at least.
Is there a special appearance on Family Guy in the cards for Mauro Ranallo?
Well, I've been told I kind of look like Seth MacFarlane. I've been told I kind of sound like the dog Brian. So maybe he's already remote viewing. Maybe he's doing some inception of his own and coming into my world and stealing some things. But I love Family Guy. I'm very much into that type of humor and whatnot. But I love voiceover. I love the voice. I mean, whether it's female, male, whether it's sports, acting. I mean, Liev Schreiber, who was a very accomplished actor who does all the HBO 24/7 voiceovers and commercials. I think he's got an amazing set of pipes. And I've always been a big fan of the spoken word. So there are a lot of people I look up to and respect in that regard.
After working for a couple of radio stations in BC, you began calling kickboxing fights and doing MMA for TSN. Now, this is of particular interest for me, this question. How does one go from small-time radio in BC to the nation's largest sports network?
Yeah, well, in fact, I'm going to give you the Coles Notes version here of my entire career, and you'll see the spectrum, and you'll probably wonder, wait a minute, that's not supposed to happen. As I mentioned, always knew what I wanted to do because my parents were immigrants from Italy, not knowing the English language very well when they came in, and then, the beginning of the 70s, you got your three channels. Professional wrestling was always ubiquitous, and the fact that it was a morality play where you didn't really have to understand the language but know who was, the good guy and the bad guy,
right.
And it was a cheap form of entertainment. My parents introduced me to pro wrestling at a very young age, and like most kids, I got infatuated, obsessed with it, but already knowing at the time that genetically I was never going to be a professional wrestling superstar. But I loved the sport. I loved the announcers. I loved the showmanship, the drama. So I got hooked on pro wrestling very, very young age, and again, always kind of felt maybe this is something I should get into. And at the age of 16, a very fortuitous break for myself. I just came back from a wrestling tournament at Simon Fraser University. I was a high school amateur wrestler, and All-Star Wrestling, the promotion out of Vancouver, was doing a charity show at my high school with the promoter. The late Al Tomko was doing the ring announcing for the show, trying to save costs. And as a kid, knowing, everything about these guys, I was kind of that pest who know-it-all who went up to him and started to try to impress him with all of my knowledge of his promotion at the time. I think I was more of a pest to him than anything else. But after a few minutes, he actually said, "Hey, kid, have you ever handled a microphone?" And my friend who was with me at the time kind of smirked, saying, "You know, he's the biggest mouth in the school. He's a school announcer." And they asked me to ring announce the finish of the match because he had to take care of some business in the dressing room. And really, this was the genesis of my career. I found myself ad-libbing the rest of the show. The promoter came back to me afterwards with a smile on his face saying, "Holy smokes, kid, you know, you're very good at this stuff." He wanted my name and number. I thought, maybe, okay, this is cool. He wants me to do some ring announcing at some local shows or whatnot. The next thing I know, 2 weeks later, I'm on BCTV, seen across Canada on the CTV affiliates as a 16-year-old kid. And that's where my broadcasting career began. No post-secondary education, no real training. I was kind of thrown into the deep end. And due to the fact that the show at the time, the wrestling show, wasn't of the highest quality, I guess someone with even an iota of talent, speaking or otherwise, would stick out. And because I was so young, I did manage to garner some attention. And from there, I went into radio at 17, worked for my hometown radio station, of course, Fraser Valley Radio Network in Chilliwack and Abbotsford. And really, the funny thing is, I got on TSN because of my involvement with Stampede Wrestling with Bruce Hart and the legendary Hart family in Calgary. After a few weeks of doing their shows on A-Channel in Alberta, a promoter, the fight promoter, who was also involved with our production team, asked me if I was interested in doing Muay Thai. At the time, I don't even know if I could spell the word Muay Thai, let alone announce it, but we became the first promotion to air nationally on Canada on TSN. And really, one thing I've always prided myself on, and something I tell young broadcasters coming up, and I feel very good in being able to share this with everybody. The key to being a successful broadcaster, I feel, and like everything in life, is preparation. Always be prepared. Know as much as you can, and never, never go in without knowing what is going on. Like, you have to know everything in order to be an authoritative voice and whatnot. And to be honest with you, my Muay Thai, knowledge got so good that I learned all the moves in Thai, in actual Thai language, and did a show speaking it, not in Thai, like doing the play-by-play in English, but all the moves in Thai. Didn't go over very well with TSN. They told me to go back to calling the spinning back elbow and not a sock clap. So I, again, maybe right place at the right time. I filled out one application form in my entire life, and like I say, my journey goes from being on TSN with Muay Thai to meeting Boss Rudin in 2001 in Vancouver at a grappling tournament at BCIT. I was asked to be an announcer in a very low budget martial arts film that the only reason it was green lit was because Boss Rudin was going to be in it. And he and I had amazing chemistry instantly. And he was one of those individuals who looked at me and said, "You know what? I would like to work with you again someday." And I kind of, thought at the time, I'll get my guys to call your guys. We'll do lunch sometime. You never hear back from these people. Well, certainly Boss Rudin, a man of his word, who kept in touch with me intermittently. And then in July of 2003, when, believe it or not, I was probably at my lowest in terms of health and life and everything else, I get a phone call from Boss Rudin that changed my life. And as the reason I am where I am today, because he told me to send a demo tape of whatever combat sports stuff I had done, which at the time was Muay Thai, and to send it to Pride Fighting Championships in Los Angeles. And, as the cliche says, the rest is history. And I ended up going to Japan 31 times in 3 years and have now been a part of the Showtime MMA family and, of course, the anchor with the Fight Network and the Score. And, I mean, it goes on and on. But really, Boss Rudin, El Wapo, is the reason Mauro Ranallo exists in the current form that I am. So I will always be eternally grateful to him to keeping his word and giving me a chance to sink or swim.
So it was basically just a chance meeting with Boss, and the two of you just got along and you went from there?
Yeah, it's as simple as that, my friend. We did, like I say, we played announcers in a small, very, I think it went directly to the bottom of the bargain bin, not even to the top of the bargain bin, but the chemistry and the fact that I made some kind of an impression on him. And the funniest thing is, and not even funny, but he is, to this day, whether we see each other once a year, twice a year, one of my best friends, and just someone who is, like I say, I wish every, and that's why I kind of try to give back myself. Like, I want to help, you know, people flourish in their respective careers as well, and that's something I've always pride myself on, is that no matter how famous or how successful I get, I really, truly believe in karma, and I believe that, you know, it's not what you are able to accomplish, but what you help others accomplish that makes you a great person. So thanks to people like Boss Rude and whatnot, I've, you know, been able to hopefully help others along the way, and it's been a tremendous ride so far, and I hope it continues with, you know, for many years.
You've mentioned that you and Boss are still very good friends. Professionally, what was it like working with him? Because the two of you had just an amazing chemistry together. You were arguably one of the best announced teams that the sport has seen. Was that just instantaneous? Did you two just click, or how did that work out?
Yeah, and well, first of all, thank you very much, and I appreciate the kind words. And it's funny how even many years later now, it's been, you know, almost 5 years since I worked with Boss on a professional level, that no matter where I go, I still get, you know, a handful of people coming up and up. I really miss you and Boss, you and Boss. And you know, not to take away, I thought Stephen Quadros and Boss Rudin were a great team. I think Mike Goldberg and Joe Rogan do a great job. I really enjoy working with everyone I do now. In fact, Pat Miletich has become a tremendous analyst. Frank Shamrock, you know, and I get to work with Stephen now. But with Boss, going back to that, it was not work, my friend. It was two buddies hanging out, talking about fights, doing the greatest job in the world, best seats in the house. And to be honest with you, I think Boss Rudin is at his best when he has that straight man who can also be the anchor and just guide him to where he needs to be with his own charisma. I've never seen, you know, there is without a doubt no one I think has more natural charisma that I've come across. And I've met, you know, actors and other athletes from other sports and in life. But Boss Rudin, he comes into a room and, I mean, he's putting major wattage inside that cottage. The guy's just he's a cartoon character. He's a walking cartoon character who just happens to be one of the baddest men on the planet. And that's what makes him such a unique individual. But no, I mean, there was definitely a lot of prep on my part, but working with Boss Rudin remains, you know, one of the highlights of my career.
What is the craziest thing you've seen Boss do?
I would have to, what's the old saying? I might have to remove you from the earth if I hear that. You know what? People have heard the legendary stories of when Boss used to party and whatnot. And I mean, we all go through our stages in life with our vices, whether it's alcohol, whether it's just, you know, going out every night and having a good time. But for Boss Rudin, the craziest thing, I think, is just being that way 24/7. I mean, we would party some nights in Japan till like the crack of dawn, and yet he'd be training 2 hours later. He'd be in the gym doing stuff while I'm like, you know, out on my feet trying to get some sleep. The guy is just a genetic freak, a genetic machine. And for me, I guess the craziest thing he ever did to me, and something that's taken on a life of its own, was when he set up the punk before Ashton Kutcher made Getting Punked famous with what he did to me in my second major show. Yes, being punked out by Mirko Krokop, which, again, it kind of blows my mind. But to this day, I still get people, whether they're tweeting me, coming up to me on the street saying, you know, how much they enjoyed, which I don't know how nice that is to me, but enjoyed getting me you know, scared witless by Mr. Krokop back in the day.
Yeah, I actually watched that on YouTube just to prepare for this, and it still gives me a laugh to this day.
Well, and you know what? It's funny when I look back on it, only because you know what Mirko Krokop has been like with the media, the character that he's cultivated, the persona, as it were, which really isn't a persona. That's him. I mean, the guy was an anti-terrorist soldier in Croatia. He's just a guy who, in his own inner circle, the guy is amazingly funny, and there are other videos that show that online, but at the time, he was a guy that is still intimidated the crap out of me. Here's my second major show, and he was a great performer in that bit. And, yeah, I'm glad that people have been able to get a chuckle at my expense.
Towards the end of your run in Pride, you were paired with Frank Trigg. How was working with Frank different from working with Boss?
Well, Frank, obviously, again, a very successful fighter and someone who really wants to do well in broadcasting. And again, a guy with his own unique charisma. You know, he's done his reality show bits, and he's got his own, you know, he likes to push the envelope, Frank. And to be honest with you, at first it was a bit of a negotiating process, because obviously I was very upset that Boss was no longer a part of the team. But at the same sense, being a professional, I wanted to welcome Frank Trigg with open arms. And I think think, you know what, at the end of the day, I thought we did as good a job as any team in terms of trying to put the fighters over. And again, working with Pride Fighting Championships during its halcyon days, you know, when it was at the peak, it was the easiest job in the world to some degree. The fights, the production, I mean, all we had to do was make sure we didn't screw up too bad and let the action speak for itself. And, no, I enjoyed working with Frank Trigg, and I'm glad that he's still, you know, in his own unique way, still working with HDNet and others. I think there needs to be, you know, a bigger pool of talent to choose from in terms of MMA broadcasting. And another guy who really, you know, and again, I speaking about karma and helping others, someone that I can, you know, honestly say I helped at least get some recognition is Ariel Helwani, who is now, you know, one of the best MMA reporters and probably one of the best MMA interviewers in the business. Thanks
Absolutely.
To yourself, of course, sir.
Yes, thank you. Thank you for adding that.
So, yeah, so it's, no, I enjoyed working with Frank. And to really be honest, I mean, there's no dirt in my closet or whatever. Every person I've worked with in a broadcasting realm, I've enjoyed working with.
As you said, the Pride Halcyon days, you had the opportunity to witness some of the truly great fights in the sport during this time period. What were your favorite fights to call or just moments that you witnessed in Pride?
Ah, man, the list is endless, but off the top of my head, the Miracle Krokop challenging Fyodor Emelianenko for the heavyweight championship. To this day, many peers, many, even my critics, of which there have been some, say that it was probably the best called heavyweight title fight in MMA history, so I'm very proud of that moment. I always hearken back to September of 2005, the Bushido 9 show, the tournament, which Takanori Gomi had two fight of the year candidates in one night against Tatsuya Kawajiri and Luis Azevedo, and that card was just stacked. I look back at, you know, of course, Pride was always about, you know, putting on some of the larger-than-life spectacles. I was the, you know, first person to do the first Olympic gold medal versus Olympic gold medalist. The fight wasn't nothing to write home about, but just the fact that it happened. Rulin Gardner, you know, the man who ended Alexander Karelin's 13-year winning streak against Hidehiko Yoshida. I mean, Vanderlei Silva, anytime he stepped into the ring, the Hua brothers. The fights, just every card of Pride, and this is one thing I wish every MMA fan, new or old, would have been able to experience. We came to Las Vegas twice. I did the first Las Vegas show, and I know the second Las Vegas show was incredible because of the Takanori Gomi, Nick Diaz fight, but I've already left by that stretch.
Yeah.
But in order to really experience what Pride was about, you needed to go to Japan, be at the Saitama Super Arena, and just bask in the glory of what was, I always say, a cross between the Super Bowl, your favorite rock concert, and a Broadway hit. It was just unbelievable. And maybe it wouldn't go over the same way here in North America because, you know, there's more of the sports feel to MMA now with the UFC and whatnot. And yet I still think that they need to, you know, there needs to be that hype. There needs to be that marketing like Chael Sonnen is doing for his fight coming up with Anderson Silva. Oh, and sure. Not everyone is a fan of that kind of stuff, but to me, it just made it look like the best of everything I was about. Whether it's drama, whether it's sports, spectacle, hype, athleticism, Pride was, you know, you always try to, I find we always try to romanticize things when they're gone, and, you know, the good old days really weren't that good. But with all due respect to every event, and there have been some tremendous UFC cards, and of course, I love working with Showtime and Strikeforce, but there will only be one Pride, and I'm so fortunate to have gone there 31 times in 3 years, and again, and we'll always be eternally grateful that I was given that opportunity.
And UFC has certainly sat most of the talent away after they bought them out. One person that they never picked up, though, and I can't understand why, is the female announcer, the Dragon Lady.
Yes,
how is she not
Hart.
Working in some form of MMA right now? Because, you know, the when you hear that screech, you know, whether you want to or not, the hairs on the arms stand up.
Well, and that's you know, it's funny because Lenny Hart and I, in many different ways, have a lot in common. Like, Lenny Hart is not just the screaming banshee lady. She is a very acclaimed voiceover artist, a very acclaimed jazz singer. She's a Renaissance woman and a very talented woman, but you're right. She still does the dream shows in Japan, of course, which, you know, the Japanese MMA scene, not what it once was, but
no.
She's still there. And in fact, you'll be able to hear her, thankfully. And again, you talk about career highlights. highlights, you know, coming out in October, the EA Sports MMA video game, of which I was just blown away to be asked to be the play-by-play voice for that game. She also appears in that game as a as an announcer. So North American fans will still be able to get their fill of Lenny Hart coming up in the fall.
Well, EA just earned my money. Well, you left Pride in November 2006. It was shortly before they ceased operations. Was it just a case of seeing the writing on the wall and jumping ship? Or did it have anything to do with the rumors that you and Pride's American producer Jerry Millen had a falling out?
Yeah, no, it's it had everything to do with the latter, and unfortunately, that's you know, I've dealt with it, I put it to sleep. So I mean, with all, you know, I hope you don't mind. I don't really want to rehash that stuff, but it was because of who you just mentioned, and and I don't really even want to say his name. It's not worth it to me. He you know. There, in every profession, you're going to meet a few bad apples, and unfortunately, he and I never got along from the get-go. And he did a few things that really, you know, you can forgive and forget, but I'm not willing to forgive, nor will I ever forget. And I'll leave it at that.
Fair enough. You were the voice of Elite XC from their first show up until the bitter end. What are some of your memories working with Elite XC?
Well, it you know, getting to be on CBS as a Canadian boy from Mount Lehman, British Columbia, was, you know, for any broadcaster, just an immense thrill, and again, an honor and a privilege to even work with a guy like Gus Johnson, who was you know, the voice of CBS NFL and March Madness and the NBA, like a real consummate sportscaster who's still getting his reps in MMA. And I know you know, he's come under fire in because of some of his MMA commentary, but you know what? It's what it is. You got to learn to play different roles. Of course, if I had my druthers, I'd love to be the play-by-play guy for all of the MMA shows in Strikeforce. But the fact that I'm still a part of the team and with Frank Shamrock, who is, you know, of course, a legend and a very good friend, and with Gus, who brings that mainstream sports credibility to MMA, I'm very, very happy. But with Elite XC, you know, unfortunately, really, you could tell, and this is happening over and over in MMA, is that I knew from the get-go they were the Dolly Parton of MMA organizations, as I called them. They were too top heavy, man. I mean, the amount of money they spend on office space, the amount of chiefs you know, or the cooks in the kitchen, it was doomed to fail, and that's what happened. Self-fulfilling prophecy. But conversely, I think Strikeforce doing what it's doing now and with the partnership with Showtime and what we've already been able to accomplish in a very short period of time, I don't think people realize that, you know, in the grand scheme of things, Strikeforce has only been at this now a couple of years. And you know, the UFC's been at it now 16 years and riding the tidal wave of success as it deserves, and just everything that Zuffa's done to put the sport of MMA on the map. I do think there is plenty of room, and not just because, you know, I get paid to say this maybe, but I mean, there has to be competition. And I think Strikeforce is the one promotion that can be not even viable competition, but just another opportunity for fighters to get work. This is not, you know, an MMA, and this, I'm a fan first and foremost. If I was never known, if no one ever wanted to interview me, I'd be fine with that. I love the fact that I'm able to put over what I truly believe, coming from a mainstream sports background, loving hockey, doing plenty of hockey, a lot of other sports, but I believe mixed martial arts is the greatest and purest form of competition on earth, and the fact that I get to call some of the biggest fights, or just even get to call the sport for a living, is, again, you know, I have to pinch myself at times, but that's really what it means to me, is that I get to put over these tremendous athletes and all the stories that these athletes have, as I'm sure you have on your show, and the athletes that you interview, the same that I do on my own radio show. I mean, I look at last week, for instance. I had Brian Stann, who at the age of 24 had a platoon of 42 men in Iraq, Operation Matador. They were ambushed for six consecutive days by Iraqi insurgents. All 42 men, aged 18 to 21, under a 24-year-old kid, and I call a 24-year-old a kid now that I'm 40, all of them survived, and yet now he's a mixed martial artist coming off his first submission win in the fight of the night last
Sunday.
You know what I mean? Like, there are so many incredible stories, and that's why it bothers me to no end that this radio interview is emanating from one of the most beautiful places on earth, a home of some of the most ardent, knowledgeable mixed martial arts fans on the planet, and yet you have a an ignorant government, just like in Ontario, just like in New York, whether it's because of the old school boxing mentality, whether it's because of pure ignorance and this whole, you know, the BS of human cockfighting back in the day. The sport has evolved. The sport is legitimate, and it's time that the government of Vancouver, Ontario, New York, you know, just wake up and bring the sport to the masses, because it's absolutely ridiculous that I even have we're having this conversation about that. And I always try to, you know, try to temper, because I know the more you yell and scream, the more, you know, people will just tune you out. But it really does piss me off, my friend.
How could it not? You know, it's they have a sellout crowd here. Everyone seems to be going ballistic in a positive way for it. And then as soon as it's over, you know, it seems like it's two steps forward, one step back.
Well, and again, I don't like, I mean, there are many things I don't like, but that does not mean that they're not allowed to exist. Oh, Mauro Ranallo doesn't like golf, so golf needs to be banned. No, excuse me. If you don't like it, don't watch it. But there has been proven stats. Look at the UFC, the biggest pay-per-view, or the biggest company on pay-per-view, the biggest MMA organization in the world. You look at its top 10 for pay-per-views on a monthly basis or twice a month, whenever. More than half are Canadian cities. Of those cities, the two major ones, Vancouver and Toronto, the MMA is not allowed to be held. Well, MMA in Vancouver under that trial period. But go and ask the restaurants. Go and ask the hotels. Go and ask all the ancillary income places what a UFC or an MMA event brings to the city. And then let's see these government officials, well, it's not a priority, healthcare, this stuff. Well, you guys have done a really good job with healthcare and education and all that other stuff. So, well, you know, in the meantime, just legalize it and then leave us alone. Just legalize it and leave us alone. And then you can thank us later when your coffers are being filled by all this tax revenue.
Yeah, they've talked about having a GSP and cost check in Rogers Centre in Toronto.
Yes.
Do you think MMA will be sanctioned in Ontario by then?
No, I truly, you know what? The cautiously optimistic person in me would like to say yes. Tom Wright, of course, now hired as UFC president of Canada. Well, let's face it, bud. That's September, October. That's 4 months. There's no way on earth it's going to happen in Rogers Centre. And it's sad, because GSP against a broomstick would sell that place out.
Absolutely. A personal appearance. It wouldn't even have to be a fight, I don't think. Going back to Elite XC, what was it like working for Gary Shaw and his son Jared? You mentioned that you thought it was doomed to failure.
Yeah.
Do you think that the Shaws had a genuine love for the sport, or were they just trying to branch off from boxing and make a quick buck?
To be honest, I think maybe Jared. I know that Jared Shaw, with all of his foibles and whatnot, a very interesting character. I think he was a huge MMA fan, the son. I really, truly believe that. Gary Shaw, he's a promoter. He's a successful boxing promoter. I think I knew we were doomed to fail when one of my first meetings with Gary Shaw, and I have nothing bad to say about Gary Shaw, to be honest with you. I don't think Gary Shaw was the biggest reason that Elite XC failed by any stretch of the imagination. I know that he was instrumental in pushing Kimbo Slice before he was ready. And yet, you know, hindsight being what it is, at the time, you know, Kimbo Slice, and he still remains, believe it or not, a draw. You know,
sure.
He had nothing going for him.
Even housewives know the name Kimbo Slice.
Well, there you go. And that's, you know, whether good or bad, you know, that's due to Gary Shaw. So, I mean, Kimbo's bank account, I'm sure, is thanking him. But when it comes to MMA, I knew what Gary Shaw was all about when he said, with a straight look on his face, "Hey, Ranallo, what do you think about putting midgets in the cage?"
You're kidding. Come on, man.
No, I'm not kidding.
You've got to be ribbing me right now. He wanted to stage midget MMA fights?
I don't know how far he wanted to go with it, but that was his mindset. So, again...
Somebody get Eric Bischoff on the line.
Well, there you go. You know, he's thinking like a promoter. And that's, you know, you bring up, you know, Sleazy, I call him, not Easy. I've had my dealings with Eric Bischoff in the past, not one of my favorite people. But this whole thing, too, about pro wrestling and mixed martial arts and how the two can't coexist. If people want to do their research, go back to 2005 when the Ultimate Fighter first season aired on Spike, which was preceded by Raw.
Yep.
That's the Raw audience is what put the Ultimate Fighter on the map, and conversely, or as a byproduct, I mean, saved the sport. It was because of the Ultimate Fighter and the, you know, the Forrest Griffin, Stephen Bonner seminal moment that they had at the end of the season that, you know, really exploded the sport. So, and I mean, look at Brock Lesnar, biggest draw in the sport from a pro wrestling background. I have no problem with people saying, you know, pro wrestling, how dare you compare the two? I'm not comparing the two. Marketing-wise, MMA and the UFC's shown it, and every other successful promotion promotion like Pride back in the day has shown it, can take pages from a pro wrestling marketing handbook. And whether you like it or not, and whether you believe that Chael Sonnen is going to even have a chance of beating Anderson Silva, I'll tell you, there are a lot more people going to be watching Chael Sonnen versus Anderson Silva because of Sonnen's talking ability than would have if he didn't say anything at all.
Well, does that have more to do with Anderson, though, being the champ and coming in, you know, obviously with some questions to answer after the Maya fight and the latest fight and even the Cote fight?
Yeah, no, Anderson Silva is in a position right now where he better, and this is what I'm hoping does happen, and I love, you know, again, a big fan of Chael Sonnen's work. I had him on the radio show last week. The guy's an amazing promo, the best in all of combat sports. But I truly believe, I'm hoping that he awoken the real inner warrior that is Anderson Silva. Say what you will about Silva's shenanigans in the last few fights against Latus and Maya and even going back to the Patrick Cote fight, but when he's on, the guy is, you know, next to the GSP and Jose Aldo's of the world. Mm-hmm. You know, he is, without a doubt, one of the best fighters ever. 11-fight winning streak right now in the octagon, a record. 7 mm-hmm. title defenses, a record. We saw what he did to Forrest Griffin at 205. I really believe Anderson Silva is going to come out and steamroll Chael Sonnen and prove to everyone that he is the baddest man on the planet. But having said that, I don't know mentally where he's at. On the conference call to sell the fight, he was very terse, very curt with reporters. And
that's usually how he is, though. Am I right?
But see, that's the thing. And that's where he's doing himself a disservice because the fans want to like Anderson Silva, and he's making it very difficult.
That's true. Oh, once you get past Sonnen's relentless trash talking, though, is there anything there skill-wise that could really beat Silva? I mean, Silva's already run through Dan Henderson, and yep. Henderson's a better wrestler and he's got better hands than Sonnen. Is there anything
sure.
Sonnen can do other than a good clean shot? You know, yep. What can he do to beat Silva?
Well, the one, you know, I hear you, and that's a good question. The one thing that Sonnen brings is, and you mentioned already, Dan Henderson, higher level wrestler and whatnot. Sonnen brings a very aggressive style of MMA wrestling, and in order for Sonnen to be successful, he needs obviously to swarm Silva, clinch, bring it to close quarters immediately, avoid his long limbs and his deadly Muay Thai and his deadly accurate striking. So even setting the scenario up, he has to take him down and control him on the ground. And, of course, we know about Anderson's Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu black belt and what he did, you know, with the likes of Nathan Marquardt and Travis mm-hmm. Luter and all these other guys who are better submission grapplers than Chael Sonnen. Sonnen, like you say, either has to count on the Hail Mary or he has to win very, very ugly, which, unfortunately, again, wouldn't do, the UFC any favors in a headline fight. But
he'd be praying for Silva and Okami at that point, I think.
Well, and that's, that's the thing. I mean, even Okami, who won a close split decision over Mark Munoz on Sunday. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is the whole debate that goes on in MMA. If it's pure sport, or is it show business as well? And nowadays, with everything, whether it's hockey, football, whatever, you have to entertain the crowd, and you have to put together the best fights. Like, I hate to say it, MMA is a sport, but even more so, it is a business. And I think as soon as the diest of, hardcores accept that, the better they'll sleep at night and know that, there are no real rankings. There'll never be any real rankings. It look at Brock Lesnar, in his fourth fight becomes heavyweight champion. It's look at boxing where these padded records, 28-0, whereas, in our sport, 16-10 guy like Randy Couture is a legend. So it is what it is. MMA is everything, I think, that makes everybody want to emotionally invest themselves in anything on television, whether it's the drama, the storylines, the unbridled action. To be honest with you, I eat, live, and breathe it. And I think one of the reasons I am so enamored more than anything, and I maybe speak for others, I played baseball not very well. I played hockey not very well. I played soccer, football, all the sports. You have to be a different type of animal to step into a cage and get punched in the face and enjoy it. Like, that's just the breed of these people, these athletes. I challenge anyone in any form, whether marathon runners or NFL football players. We're seeing it already now. More and more other sports are undertaking MMA training regimens because they know that MMA athletes are the toughest people on earth, and they train more diligently than anyone on earth. You have to be someone special, and that's why I don't care if it's even Kimbo Slice, if it's Jose Canseco, who, of course, I think, is an idiot, but if you get into a cage or ring, you've got my eternal respect for life, because you are a different person.
Definitely, definitely. After Lee Dexy went under and Showtime decided they still wanted to be in the MMA business, was it a given that you would continue to be Showtime's voice of MMA?
Not at all. In fact, at the time when Elite XC went under, it was with trepidation myself. I've always been fortunate enough. Obviously, I'm a rare breed even within the broadcast community of MMA. I have a daily radio talk show, shameless plug coming up here on Sirius 98, which you can access on HardcoreSportsRadio.com. I was, with the Fight Network as an anchor there. Now I'm with the Score as their combat sports, anchor and doing the weekly MMA show. But my first love is play-by-play, and whether it is hockey, whether it's wrestling, whether it's MMA, I love to be the soundtrack. I love to add whatever moments of, I'm still, to this day, people either love it or hate it, but thankfully I think more and more people love it. My call of Kevin Randleman's stunning knockout of Mirko Krokop, where I literally lost it, and people are saying, wow, you planned that. No, I didn't plan that, because that's what I'm like on the couch when I'm watching fights at home, watching the UFC. I'm a fan first and foremost, man. I just want to be the voice of the fan, and I'm just wanting to be the soundtrack and hopefully allow these athletes' stories to be told and allow people to emotionally invest. But at the time, I was like anyone else, wondering if, at that moment, whether it was it for me on a big scale. But you know what's been, again, whether it's luck or whatever it is, it was a very quick, seamless transition to where I received phone calls saying, we want you to remain a part of the Showtime family, and we are looking at other companies, and I'm glad that they chose Strikeforce, because even with Elite XC, there was the two shows we co-promoted with Strikeforce that were the most memorable shows in Elite XC short tenure.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned, just the reaction that just takes it over you sometimes. What was going on in your head when you watched Fabricio Werdum doing what many people figured was impossible and tapping out Fedor Emelianenko?
Yeah, as people who watch the broadcast might note, Ranallo was rather inconspicuously silent throughout that entire fight. And to be honest with you, I did not have my best night that night for a variety of reasons, and still trying to get comfortable with my role as an analyst on the CBS or on the major Strikeforce shows. And to be honest with you, at that moment in time, I was thinking what everyone else was thinking, like, wow, it happened. And yet it's weird. I almost just sat there going, I knew it was going to happen eventually. And for some reason, I don't know why, but to me at that moment in time, and I guess because of my mindset throughout that evening, and again, for anyone who cares, I apologize that maybe I wasn't at my best that night, but it was almost anticlimactic to me because there, in a rather unprofessional term, maybe, and I'll admit this, it almost felt like I wish I had that call, to be honest with you. I wish I had that call. But having said that, you're a professional broadcaster. I was supposed to give my comments. But having said that, I just was shocked, surprised, and very happy for Fabricio Werdum. And I mean, Fyodor Emelianenko is an amazing class act, very humble individual who, people can say what they will about him. He admitted he made a mistake. The unfortunate thing with Fyodor, is that whether, I don't know what's going on with M1 Global and all of that thing, but it's sometimes, it raises some questions about what is best for him now. And I don't know if we're ever going to see him, ever go to the UFC. I think there's still some very marketable fights for him, including a rematch with Fabricio Werdum. I think we all want to see that. Mm-hmm. I still would want to see him fight Alistair Overeem. And this, again, goes to what we talked about earlier. Yes, wins and losses are important, but you know what? There are still guys, I don't care if they lose three in a row, I still want to see guys fight certain other matchups despite their record, because I think they'll be entertaining fights. And I think that's what Strikeforce is trying to do, is just produce a solid night of fights. And I know some people have problems with that because they're, you got to build the champions and, this doesn't make sense. You're putting this guy in a title fight coming off a loss. Well, Strike Forces Promotion, they can do what they want.
Yep.
And frankly, I mean, you know, considering the price, which is either a premium cable bill with Showtime or, you know, Super Channel here in Canada, you get, you know, very good bang for your buck. And I, again, look forward to being in Phoenix, Arizona next week for the women's one-night tournament. The four ladies, of course, vying for a shot at the 135-pound title. And then the week after, we're in Houston, Texas for a couple of championship fights. So, I mean, Strike Force, I think, is going to be around for the long haul, especially with the support of Showtime. Whether or not we go back to CBS, I want to commend, and I do want to say this publicly, Kelly Call, who is one of the big wigs at CBS, a huge MMA fan, and someone really who, you know, when I say this guy went to bat for Strike Force and the sport, I really mean he went to bat. And, you know, unfortunately, we haven't had the greatest luck on CBS in terms of the fight quality and you know, the post-fight melee, of course, with what happened in Nashville. But
sure, all the Caesar Gracie boys.
Fingers crossed. Yeah, I'm keeping my fingers crossed that maybe once or twice a year, you know, we go to CBS. And I know now with the UFC on Versus, I think that's opening up some doors for them to maybe possibly end up on NBC, which was just purchased by the same company that owns Versus down the road. So, you know, who's to say that MMA needs network TV? We've also discussed that. I mean, there are, maybe it is a niche sport with just a very ardent following, and hopefully we can grow the sport the way we're doing it now organically. I know that people say, you know, you got to bring in the millions and all of this, but steady goes the race here. It's not a sprint.
Well, I mean, yeah, UFC seems to be doing all right for themselves just with pay-per-view and a cable show. So
very much. No, UFC is again. I mean, they're it's amazing actually the amount of success that they've been able to cultivate, and thank goodness. I mean, the way the UFC goes is the way the sport goes now, but I'm glad that, you know, there are alternatives. I enjoy Bellator. I enjoy WEC. I think WEC, along with Strikeforce, maybe deliver the most consistent product. I mean, and it's just sad that, you know, people are conditioned to no offense to the bigger fighters, but even the UFC on Versus show last Sunday, it drew about a million, a little less than the show they did in March, but, you know, you got Jon Jones, who's an amazing superstar in the making,
right.
Yet you come off the show that WEC did in Edmonton where every fight was amazing, or their pay-per-view where it was one of the best cards I've ever seen, and yet the Edmonton show, I think, in the States did less than 400,000 viewers on Versus for WEC. And really, if people who are MMA fans watched the show, they, you know, it was as entertaining, if not more so, than last Sunday's event. So it's about branding, and it's about just conditioning people, just like we've seen in boxing. The heavyweight division sucks in boxing. We all want to see Pacquiao and Mayweather, a couple of 140, 147 pounders. The same thing in MMA. The little guys, man, always deliver.
Absolutely. Do you think things like Fedor losing and the defection of Jake Shields to UFC, do you think that'll hurt Strikeforce long term?
You know what? I think, to be quite honest, and I, again, Jake Shields, a tremendous fighter, won 14 in a row, and this goes and speaks again. Strikeforce, being a television entity with Showtime and where we are at CBS, has never proven to be a draw. And frankly, I think Strikeforce, you know, they didn't get into a bidding war with the UFC, nor should they have. And I think everybody is where they're supposed to be. I think Jake Shields in the UFC, of course, raises some interesting scenarios. I think he faces a very tough test in Martin Kamen right off the bat.
Yeah.
But like everyone else, I would like to see Jake Shields one day fight GSP. And so, I mean, now it can possibly happen. The loss of Fedor... I don't know. I think, again, one thing Strikeforce has to do, and they're busy doing now, is growing its roster, working the challenger shows. I mean, there's a lot of up-and-coming guys that they can create as their own in-house superstars. The Ty Woodleys, the Luke Rockholds, the Daniel Cormiers, the King Moes, Kennedys, the Jacarés. I mean, there
the Sarah
are, Nick Diaz. There's a lot of guys now that we, you know, everyone says, if they're not in the UFC, you suck. Well, that's not necessarily the case.
No, definitely not.
I think there's a lot of talent out there that's yet to be discovered or is being cultivated now, like I say, whether Bellator or whatnot. And as if you're a fan of mixed martial arts, then hopefully you watch all MMA and not just the UFC, but obviously for the casual fan, the UFC is still the first choice, and that's fine. I think for the most part they do a tremendous job, and I'm glad to be a part of this MMA wave. It's actually, you know, amazing and how much the sport has grown and how much it continues to grow, and the fact that, you know, I was fortunate to have Canada's first and dare I say most comprehensive mixed martial arts program, and able to bring a daily a show on the radio talking about combat sports just shows how far the sport has come.
Absolutely. You mentioned Strikeforce and their up-and-coming stars. Did Sarah Kaufman earn her way onto the bigger Strikeforce cards with her powerbomb TKO?
Yeah, I mean, I'm a old, see, it's weird. I think I'm a contradiction like most humans are, but when it comes to the titles, I'm always of the belief that championships should, if you're going to have a championship, they should be on the major show. They should be in feature attraction places, whether main events or co-main events. I know some people were down on Sarah after her title-winning performance against Hashi, in which, you know, a lot of people in the venue left because they were not happy with the action, so to speak.
It was a slower-paced fight.
Yeah, you know, and it was, but it's like, okay, you know, not every fight can be a fight of the year. Not every fight can be a barn burner. And I think Sarah Kaufman proved beyond a shadow of a doubt that she belongs on the bigger stage. She's 12-0, she's a champ. And I would hope they're only, and again, to be fair to Strikeforce and the matchmakers and the promotion, there are only so many slots available on the big cards. There's only two more, you know, those August 21st, October, and December. So there's three more major events for Strikeforce and a couple of other Strikeforce Challenger shows coming up before the end of the year. And you know, if she wants to stay active, which she does, then sometimes, you know, you have to, biggers can't be choosers. And I hate to use that term, but what I'm saying is, you know, if she has an opportunity to defend the title on Challengers, and I know Challengers is a smaller show or B show, we don't look at it upon as that. I actually think that it's one of my favorite shows to do, not only because I do play-by-play and get to work with Miletic and Quadros, but these are hungry athletes who are going to give it all it's got because they're getting their first crack at nationwide television. So I hope that...
And you've had veterans on the Challenger show, too. Matt Lindland was on the show not too long ago.
Exactly. And that's the other... You know, it's funny. We try to subscribe to the belief that, okay, this is for up-and-coming prospects. For the most part, it is. But again, like you say, when there's an opportunity to put a veteran on or bring back a veteran, then, you know, there are no rules, per se, that how, you know, an MMA show is supposed to be run or what's supposed to happen. I like the fact that there's more depth now coming to Strikeforce, and more and more of these fighters that they signed initially are becoming, you know, stars in their own right. And I'm just looking forward to more exciting fights. And I'm really looking forward to Saturday's UFC 117, a stacked card. And it's like I say, I love what I do. And the fact that I get paid to do it is you know, mind-boggling sometimes.
Boggles my mind. UFC is moving into another new market at the end of the month. Dana White's hometown of Boston. That card featuring what's being hyped as the wrestler versus boxer showdown of Randy Couture against James Toney. Does Toney bring anything to the table other than the proverbial puncher's chance?
That's all he brings. And, you know, I've never been a fan of the boxing versus MMA debate because I love both sports. I think boxing can maybe take a page out of MMA's playbook in terms of giving fans their money's worth and not just a main event that you ask people to pay, you know, an ordinary amount of money for. I think just the presentation in a boxing show can maybe be helped by what MMA has been able to do. But in this fight coming up August 28th in Boston, Randy Couture will defeat James Toney. And if Randy Couture goes and boxes James Toney the next week in a boxing ring, Randy Couture will get knocked out by James Toney. And so really this proves nothing to me. Am I interested in the fight? Of course. It's interesting to see a guy who's a surefire Hall of Famer, a very good boxer in his own right, his best days are probably behind him, taking on, again, a legend of MMA who's, you know, a freak that he's still been able to fight at the level he is in his mid-40s. But I see Randy Couture doing what he's always done. Get the clinch, pin him up along the fence, take him down, and either ground and pound him or submit him, and that's how I see this fight going.
So it's more of a spectacle, like we talked about earlier, like some of the earlier Pride cards.
Even though Dana White says says he doesn't book freak fights or whatever, that's I do believe that's a spectacle, and nothing wrong with it. I want to see Herschel Walker fight Batista. I want to see Herschel Walker fight Kimbo Slice. I like those kinds of matches. And again, I'm not so much of a purist that I don't know what could bring in some casual fans' eyeballs. And if it attracts new fans to the sport of MMA, where they look at that fight and then all of a sudden see a main event between a guy like Alistair Overeem and Fabricio Werdum or Nick Diaz versus Mayhem Miller, then they're hopefully going to be hooked and we make fans for life. So it's about the marketing of the sport, and as long as it doesn't totally insult the fans' intelligence, and with James Toney, against Randy Couture, I think it's a fight that's going to draw a lot of mainstream attention, and it'll draw some fans who might not be used to it. I think it will bring in some boxing fans. So let's see what happens. But in the long run, it doesn't mean much to the sport. And I hope people, after Randy Couture wins, MMA is better than boxing. No.
Watch Sir Dog light up.
Yeah, exactly. It's not about that, because like I say, you put James Toney in a boxing ring with Randy Couture and he'll knock him out. Same thing with Anderson Silva, Roy Jones in a fight that was speculated.
Right.
MMA, Silva killed it. So, again, people, never the twain shall meet, as Rudyard Kipling once wrote.
Very nice. Hey, at least they're not putting midgets in there, right, Marl?
Since we're being very open here, there is video footage of this somewhere, maybe in my mom and dad's home in the Valley, but I did wrestle a midget when I was 18 years old. Coconut Willie, a professional wrestling match in Cloverdale for All-Star Wrestling. I did the honors. He beat me with a Superfly Snooker Splash. I did the 1-2-3, and to this day, I could ask you, sir, have you ever wrestled a midget? Didn't think so.
No, you got me there, Mauro. all right, Mauro Ranallo. Mauro, anything else you want to plug on your way out here?
Well, you know what, buddy? I appreciate the time. I'm glad that you cover MMA there at University of British Columbia Radio. And really, I just hope your listeners will tune into the fight show Monday to Friday at 1:05 p.m. Pacific on Sirius Channel 98, or you can listen to the podcast or online at hardcoresportsradio.com. And please join me for the MMA show. Best time for the West Coast, Saturdays at 3 p.m. Pacific.
And who knows, maybe Mauro will go into the archives and find that footage of him doing the job for a midget.
I might have to bring that out somewhere. Needless to say, I think what the highlight of it, other than me getting pinned, was my mother yelling in the background, "Hit him, Mauro! Hit him!" Because I was the bad guy, so everyone else was booing me. And by the way, don't hate the mullet, because I sported a nice one in the mid-'80s.
It was the style at the time.
All right, my friend. Well, I appreciate you having me on your show, and anytime, I'd be honored to come back.
Sounds great, Mauro. No, the voice of MMA. Just hang on the line. And let me close her up, Mauro. Okay, that is it. Another great edition of In the Cage with Bards. Great guest, Mauro Ranallo, Anderson Silva, Chael Sonnen. This Sunday, or this Saturday, rather. Look at this. I'm so excited. I don't know what day it is anymore. But until next time, this has been In the Cage with Bards.